is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
You're now in the Essential Zone, where we seek to be informative, inspirational, enlightening, and dynamic. But more importantly, we seek to be fair and balanced. There comes a time when the game tolerates no spectators, only players. There comes a time when we must recognize that our individual aspirations shape our collective destiny. There comes a time when getting in the game, despite the risks, despite the challenges, regardless of the cost, is simply the right thing to do. There comes a time when we must find our hearts, find our soul, and pursue our purpose for the greater good of all, for country, for humanity. There comes a time when we must manifest our true greatness. Yes, there comes a time, and that time is now. So let's get down to the essentials. The essentials. Serious radio for serious people committed to advancing the national conversation. Good evening and welcome to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. I'm your host, Hubert Edwards. Welcome to The Essentials, The Reset. This evening, we're going to have ourselves a wonderful conversation as usual. This evening, we're talking about domestic violence,
an issue
which impacts significantly on the life of a country. Violence in any form against a member of society is violence against the collective. Because when the collective is weakened, the productive capacity of the country is weakened. This evening, we have with us a very august panel. We have individuals who are steeped in the law and individuals who have been significantly involved in the enforcement of the fight against domestic violence. And I am joining me this evening for the first time, maybe not for the last, my beautiful co-host, Ms. Savannah Jenny Smith. And this session is coming to you from the Eugene Depuge Law School, a program being planned and organized by Group F of the second-year students. And the whole idea behind this is to help to lay out a set of awareness, to develop a framework, to have persons be able to understand exactly what is out there and who the persons are who can help in the instance of you are suffering domestic abuse. Interestingly, in researching this, it's simply just more than we always think about. In many instances, we say domestic abuse, domestic violence, and we think physical. But when you do the research, it's physical, it's psychological, it's economical, it's emotional. And so this evening, we're going to have that conversation. First of all, let's see what the state of the country is. Let's then understand what some of the practical experiences are. And then we have to find a way as to how we walk through the process of protecting persons. How do we get these protective orders? And then we're going to kind of set a framework and an understanding of what persons can do in a practical way if they need help going forward. So I want to introduce to you this evening my co-host, Savannah. Savannah, welcome to The Essentials.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And we have with us Mr. Farrington. He is a lecturer from here at the Eugene Depuge Law School in the Legal Aid Clinic. Welcome, Mr. Farrington.
Good evening. Thank you for the invitation.
Yes. And we have another lecturer with us, Ms. Monroe, and she is our lecturer in advocacy. You know, brilliant lady. She has a lot of story. I remember very clearly the one with the pumps running through the bush. So we definitely will have to share that this evening, but welcome to The Essentials.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the invitation.
And we have also ASP Wims, and she is with us from the Royal Bahamas Police Force, and she's coming to bring to us the law enforcement perspective. Welcome to The Essentials, and welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Certainly a pleasure. And welcome to this, the Legal Aid Law, Eugene Depuge Law School Legal Aid Clinic roundtable on domestic violence. We have to pause here to say thanks to our partner, Organization for Responsible Governance, who are working with us on this particular project to make sure it goes to and reach as far and wide as possible. So let's get right into it. We will start with you, Mr. Farrington. Give us your quick overview of what is domestic violence and how have you engaged in this? You have the experience of being a lawyer, a tutor here, but you were also a law enforcement officer. What has been your experience in this era?
You said something earlier. When people think about domestic violence, they think about physical violence or physical attacks. But domestic violence transcends just the physical aspect of it. You have financial abuse. You have psychological, emotional. You have verbal abuse. You have situations of stalking. You have harassment. You have situations where persons may take a photograph of their genitalia and send it to someone who doesn't invite those kind of lewd photos. And so it's very wide, and it encaptures all sorts of circumstances where someone feels aggrieved or someone feels offended and someone is intimidated, is fearful for their life. So basically, it's very wide. And as the show progresses, I guess we'll dive into the different circumstances that involves the various forms of abuse.
Definitely. Ms. Monroe, and you could just tell us, how have you been attached or associated with this particular topic?
Good evening, all. My view in relation to domestic abuse, and I concur with my learned friend, is that most persons feel like it is only physical. But there are, and I would say it kind of parallels in our jurisdiction on the legal platform with cruelty. Financial abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, financial abuse, all of these things parallel in relation to domestic violence. Most persons don't feel like it is that. And in our jurisdiction, it's not only as between, let's say, partners, a husband and wife, spouse. It speaks also to partners, which means those persons who are in a relationship or who have previously been in a relationship or who have previously been spouses. It also speaks to those who are parts of a household or who have previously been parts of a household. So domestic abuse not only spans wide in relation to what it can be, Mr. Farrington has said, it speaks to stalking, it speaks to harassment, it speaks to dissemination of lewd photographs, depending on how it goes, whether civilly or criminally, can even lead to voyeurism. Those kinds of things all speak to it, and even the powers of the court, when we get there, as to how to either stop those things or put those things in place, the order in place to so stop, can be a very short order, can be a very expansive order.
Ms. Williams.
Indeed, it's a pleasure to be here this evening. My role as it relates to domestic violence, seeing cases of domestic violence over the years, has really deepened in the Bahamas, although it affects so many aspects of life, and domestic violence doesn't have a face. So you have intimate partner violence, and then you have family violence as well. That's a different category altogether. So when people look at violence or domestic violence, they only think of physical abuse, but actually it's more so mental and emotional, as well as spiritual abuse as well. You find that women, when they come and report cases of domestic violence, they actually don't even know they are being abused because they see their mothers and grandparents being abused over the years. So you look at a generational aspect of it, and it goes so deep into even our children. So when you look at society today and you look at the crime situation, you want to think and wonder, where did it come from? Sometimes we have to go back and look into the family structure. We got to look at the home system, destruction in itself, holistically. And then you got to look at the perpetrators, because maybe the perpetrators were abused as well. And then you got to look at the school system. And then you look at bullying in the school system. So it's so many aspects you actually have to address this issue, domestic violence. It's an umbrella, it's a disease that creeps into the life of everyone, inclusive of children. No one is exempted from this. No one. Every walk of life is touched by some aspect of domestic violence. But unfortunately, we have to train more because people really don't know what domestic violence is really all about.
And certainly that's one of the reasons we are here this evening. We understand very readily the idea of boyfriend-girlfriend fight, the idea of a husband and a wife having challenges. But we do not, in the broader sense and the truer sense, as outlined by you just now, exactly what it all entails. And unless we help persons to be able to properly define the problem, they are consistently going to go about solving the wrong problem. And so we want to start where we must start, where we have a very clear definition and a very clear understanding of exactly what is domestic violence. And we get a little bit more, as one of our learned director here would say, a little bit more forensic as to exactly what does it represent. You want to start as a
just to piggyback on what ASP Bim said earlier. Recently this week I did a consultation with a client, and for whatever reason her husband had this road to Damascus moment. And so all of a sudden he's super religious, to the point where anything that comes on TV, anything that comes on the radio is of the devil. And so at first blush, you may think that, well, okay, he's found God, you know, Christian home, that may be fine. But what happens in circumstances where someone is super religious? And so separate and apart from the impact that it's having on his wife, it's now trickling down to the children. Mm-hmm. So the children can't listen to their music. The children can't watch TV. You know, he wants them to pray 3-4 times a day. He wants them to go to church morning, afternoon, and night. And so, I mean, in the Bahamian context, I may be fine, but that's a form of abuse. Everybody should be free to worship whomever they want to worship, whenever they want to worship. So no one should be subjected to any kind of control when it comes to religion.
We've mentioned children a couple of times, and I'm wondering if either of you can speak to where that's specifically addressed in the legislation and what protections are there for children.
Well, I will say, I believe it is Section 3 of the Domestic Violence Protection Order Act that speaks to the definition of partner, spouses, children, and the like. Then it will be how those children have been treated, whether or not abuse is also defined in the definition section. And so if that applies to children, the person who would make that application would normally be the other parent. If there is a guardian in place, a grandmother, a sister, or auntie, who has either a foster care order, an adoption order, a guardianship order, they would normally make those applications, or social services in and of themselves can go forward and make those applications if it comes before them that something is not quite right in those particular circumstances. If it is, that those investigations bear fruit. Normally, if there is any kind of view that there is something that might not be right, the court normally uses caution and out of an abundance thereof, may well even on a temporary basis remove the child to investigate or put supervised visitation in place to investigate, just so that they can, you know, dot their I's and cross their T's. If it is that anything, and the same thing goes with adults, if it is that those children are placed in harm's way, and what springs to mind is an example where a father continually abused his daughter that I have dealt with, and a protection order needed to be put in place both for the mother and the daughter, and the mother had certain mental needs, the daughter did not, but an order needed to be put in place nonetheless for both of them. And so it was an extensive order. It was 300 feet away in relation to your home, in relation to your work, no communication by himself or anyone else, to social media, phones, no actual physical connection at all as it concerns them. And the only exception would have been the child, if it is that the child needed any kind of communication because they did not terminate his parental rights. But like I say, orders can be very short, or they can be very extensive, depending on what the court needs. Many of them can terminate rights. Many of them can be supervised visitation if that's what it needed. But in that case, the court in that moment, as with the Child Protection Act, as it evokes, the best interest of the child is what is most important in that moment.
ASP Williams, from a law enforcement perspective, just piggybacking on that. So we have the legal framework in place, and in the Bahamas, we know persons like to lament the fact that the laws are on the books, but nobody enforces them. To what extent, and I want you to kind of, focus on this more from a legalistic perspective. I know you're the police officer, you're the one who makes sure that things are, but as you look at enforcing the law, how is it that the Royal Bahamas Police Force ensures that this has been done on a consistent basis and you are actively upholding the essence of the law, so to speak, and persons can, find loophole and kind of send you back when you come to enforce an action or to take a particular action, which, as Ms. Monroe said, especially in the instance where there are children involved?
Usually when a complaint is made as it relates to any offense, and what the police does is investigate the matter once the complaint is made. And we ensure that the case is carried out to the fullest, especially as it relates to children. We get social services involved as well. And once it is found that the children are being abused in the home, we work in conjunction with social services and ensure that is done. So this is where cases would go to court in terms of once the case is actually classified to what the offense really is. Now, even as it relates to domestic violence as well, you find that when complainants go to the station and make complaints, a lot of times they don't want complaints made against the perpetrators. But even in cases when they do, the cases are reported, and especially now that the Domestic Violence Task Force unit is in place. So now we assist victims holistically. We not only take complaint statements, but we ensure as well that the cases follow through even through the court. Now, some cases, they just want, for example, they just want a protection order right away against the perpetrator, and they may not know how to do that. So in my office, what we do, we assist the family, the complainant, as well as the children, on how to receive this protection order. So we assist them in writing it, on how to fill out an application. And not only that, we also go to court with them when that court date comes. So even when the interim order is in place for the victim at the magistrate court, we also assist them when that time comes, as well as when the protection order, which is actually 2 weeks in between. So the police, we are actually doing better in terms of assisting victims now, I would say, honestly. We're doing a whole lot better. And I can say...
And by now, you're contrasting... What type of time? Like last week or 2 years ago, 1 year ago?
That's a good question. I would say a year ago, because this unit was amalgamated last year, July 5th, when the Commissioner of Police came in, Mr. Clayton Fernander. He amalgamated this unit. And what the task force unit consists of is not just police officers. We're no longer working in silos. So we have social workers attached to the unit. We have the crisis center. We have a psychiatrist. We also have nonprofit organization who also assist with cases. And we also lean heavily on the judicial system as well. So with this one partnership approach or one-stop-shop approach, we ensure that cases, our victims, receive exactly what they need in a safe space. So now they don't have to go to this place and that place for assistance, whereas now they can get that assistance that they need holistically and in a comfortable setting. So that is what it's really all about. And that is how we see cases through, not only domestic cases, whatever case that they may have, we don't turn them away. So if I can compare from last year, as you had mentioned, to this year, we have done so much better in assisting victims and perpetrators. Because you find that some perpetrators can be assisted as well. So that's where we're at now. That's where we're at.
You mentioned the what seemed like generational abuse, learned behaviors that children are seeing from their parents and perhaps perpetrating that against other, once they have children or other children even. Can you talk about, give some examples, like Mr. Farrington talked about religious abuse, for someone who's not sure if they're in an abusive situation, what signs are they looking for?
I've seen cases whereas in terms of generational, where we had cases where our victim would come in and say their mother was abused and they never left. You know, she remained in the situation and she feel as if that she's supposed to do the same thing as well. So in her mind, it's normal. It's normal to get slapped around. It's normal to be cursed at. It's normal to be called all sorts of names because her grandmother said there's nothing wrong with it. I went through it and it never killed me. And then you find so many parents, so many older parents as well, and generations past and even unfortunately to come, you find that they encourage these victims to stay, especially when they have something to lose, okay? When there are property involved. So don't let no other woman come in and take your property. You stay right there. How is your children going to manage? You stay in the relationship because I did. So that's why when I say it's a learned behavior, because the children are reared in the home of abuse. So they see this day in, day out. So now they go to the school. They go to school and they portray these bullying behavior, these aggressive behaviors. And it all stems from somewhere. And if you look in the home and if you look at parents and you look at generational, you'll find that it happened to them. So they rear them the same way.
And I think it's important as we kind of lay the foundation as to what is driving these things, that we appreciate the fact that culturally, behaviors can be normalized, and they normalize over time to become so accepted that persons, you know, and this is one of the reasons I think it's difficult, or we should really be reluctant to just criticize an individual, because you do not understand the perspective from which that person is coming. So it's against that backdrop that we understand that there are social issues driving this, there are cultural issues driving this. But the legislation itself is put in place anticipating whatsoever the drivers are, that it provides a solution. And when you look at the Section 5, for example, or I think the Section 3, yes. When you look at the legislation under Section 3, where it defines what is happening, but the legislation also goes on to say, Ms. Monroe, that in order for this protection to take place, in order for you to get these protective orders, there are certain things which the court need to be satisfied of. And I think anyone out there listening, it's not simply, okay, here is a place that you need to go, but they need to fully understand the level of evidence, the level of support that they need to bring in order to satisfy the court. Can you help us to, you know, kind of better understand the individual listening, to better understand in a broad way? You don't have to get, you know, specific in every aspect of the actual legislation, but what is it that the court is looking for? What are the standards which need to be met?
Well, I will say that what is normally, what we would akin to a domestic violence protection order, to put it as plainly as I can, is what we once would have known as a bound over. It just happens to deal with partners, spouses, members of the household, previous partners, previous spouses, children. And so what the court needs to be satisfied of, as to put it as plainly as I can, is that if the court does not empower itself to make an order to keep this person away from me, he or she will continue to engage in the behavior that will be harmful to me, whether it falls under any of the abuses we have spoken on, emotional, physical, financial, sexual, harassment, stalking, any of them. And so when you do your complaint, practically, what it normally means is that for magistrate court, there's a form that you fill out. Last time I checked, it was 50-something cents that you pay in relation to it. You go to...
Hold on. I want you to stick a point there. Because, you know, you're the learned person here. And you're doing sometimes exactly the violence that we do to persons out there.
Yes.
We skip very quickly over the cost of these things. Because some of the average individuals out there, Ms. Monroe, mm-hmm. believe that the securing of an order, the securing of protection, is expensive.
I will say, legal fees are what must fall to our learned friend.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, my learned friend, Mr. Farrington, works at the Legal Aid Clinic, and I'm very happy to hear that even the police are assisting now in the filling out of the forms. To my mind, it is no less than, no more than $1, if memory serves, maybe $3 at the most, for the filing of that documentation. Once it is filed, you can go right upstairs to the magistrate, swear your complaint, have your interim order put in place by law, which is 14 days. Within that 14 days, you have your police officer serve that person with said interim order. They will then have an opportunity to come to court and defend themselves, because everyone in the Bahamas has the right to defend whatever charges are put against them. Either they arrive and they present that position, whatever it may be, or they don't. Once proper service has been established, and proper service through the magistrate court is either putting it in your hand, putting it at your last place of abode, dropping it at your feet, and then you move forward with that order. If the magistrate is satisfied that proper service has been executed, she or he can go ahead and allow the permanent order from there. And that order can last for up to 3 years if it is that he or she, again, is satisfied of what the contents there are. And truly, if there's no one there to contest, normally they are, especially in cases of physical abuse where, you know, there may be medical evidence that you've brought before the court. I've seen people brought x-rays and the like, evidence from medical examiners and the like, or sometimes it may just be on your viva voce evidence, which means the evidence that you give when you take the stand on, this is how we treated me, my children, my home, my grandmother, whomever may be inside the home. It is not something that's going to happen overnight by any means. But if it is something that you're minded to do, there are persons who can assist you, down to persons who can assist you to get out if that is what you need to do, and not be around him, her, for some kind of time,
them.
And them, shrouded in secret if that's absolutely what needs to happen. Mm-hmm. Those organizations do exist. Those places do exist. Obviously, they're not highly publicized because it wouldn't help the persons who are, but understand that you are not alone. And while a paper will not fend off someone, it will put you in a position to at least have some protection as against that person.
Yes. And I think it's so important for the persons who are listening to understand this. First of all, there is a system of support, some of it not readily available, not readily noticeable, not available, but not readily noticeable. But once you plug into that network, you're going to be afforded the support. And I think, you know, if anything we take away from tonight, it has to be kind of your description, ASP Wims, of where the police force has shifted its intention. Because when one look at the actual legislation, and if you do a quick analysis of it, I think it envisioned that, but up to yesterday, it wasn't like that. So now you have the instance where the legislation actually envisioned the police working in concert with other agencies to make that the case. And so you support these victims or potential victims in a very holistic way. Before I go to my co-host, I know she have a million and one questions. I just want to go to Mr. Farrington as our only male panelist. Oftentimes, the experience is that there is an abused woman or abused children in the home. And there needs to be something done fast. Ms. Monroe mentioned the process, the power of the interim order, and the need for speed. Individuals who need to protect themselves, need to move fast, need to get the help. How do we afford this to them? And is the clinic, the legal aid clinic, so positioned to assist, or at least to point person in the right direction?
Well, I can say this, Ms. ASP Williams always send yes. people to me. but what I would advise, though, in the first instance, go to the police, make a complaint, document everything, so that at least you can have a paper trail.
Yeah, but this is an emergency, Mr. Farrington.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
We laying out the circumstance in an ideal circumstance. So let me give you a scenario.
Okay.
It's now 1 minute to seven. The bar bill is being paid. and somebody's on their way home. And in about 15 minutes, somebody is going to start to whimper and somebody's going to start to cry. But she's serious this time. It's the last time. What does she do?
Again, in the first instance, go to the police. Because in that situation, you may not have access to the court. And again, to obtain an interim protection order, that requires you having to complete a form. You have to swear under oath in the presence of the magistrate. You have to give some brief synopsis of what transpired before the magistrate grants the interim protection order. And even when she grants it or he grants it, it still has to be served on the perpetrator. And so if you want that quick microwave relief, go to the police. Mm-hmm. Now, once you make your complaint to the police and you have the police visit the home and speak with the individual, then my advice is the next stop is the magistrate's court to secure that order. Now, you said something earlier, even though you may have the women who is predominantly the victims in these circumstances, I've represented many men. And so, and we've been successful in the interim protection order being set aside.
Yes.
And the protection order not being granted. Because again, you may have a situation where you say the fella's stalking you. If I drive and pass my ex-girlfriend house who lived to a dead end, and she see me driving past her house, and she go before the court and characterize as stalking, one instance of me making sure the light on or making sure the street light working wouldn't be characterized as stalking. Now, stalking will have to be a little bit more than that. For instance, one act of me pushing you out of the bed, and you may receive little slight injuries, the court won't consider that domestic violence. If you read through the act, the word persistent is throughout the act. Mm-hmm. So it has to be more than one or even two acts of domestic violence. And so if I slap you once, you won't likely receive an order for domestic violence.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. And that's the way the act is constructed. So again, it bears repeating. If you want that immediate reprieve, go to the police station.
But before I go, come back to you, Savannah, you mentioned the male being the one seeking the order, because that don't happen in the Bahamas. That, as a matter of fact, that don't happen anywhere in the Caribbean. Men don't get abused. It's impossible for a man to turn up at the police station and say, my female spouse.
With a Bahamian woman?
I concur with that.
Bahamian peas and rice macaroni pork chop woman?
Okay, so help us to help the audience debunk the idea that this is limited within just a sphere of femaledom.
Well, okay. Again, people always envision domestic violence as something physical. And so if you constantly tell a man, you're just like his father, you're less than a man, you cannot financially provide for me, you may not be great and bad sexually, you may have a woman who may have an extramarital affair, and in those circumstances, she may be someone who, because she's involved in another relationship, she may be constantly searching for his phone, showing up on his job, all of those kind of things. Even though they may not be physical abuse, they may result in some psychological or emotional abuse. If you're pulling up the fella by the sports bar watching the football game, and you pull up there and you're causing a scene, all of that contribute towards some kind of embarrassment, some kind of psychological and emotional abuse or distress. And so I've had situations where I had to represent males before the court. Some of the circumstances is where the women apply for the domestic violence order. But once the evidence is borne out, the result is the woman end up being bound over to keep the peace. You know, you have situations where women go and post all of these scandalous things about their husband or their boyfriend on Facebook, or the purported or alleged mistress. The court in those circumstances have bound them over from further posting or sending WhatsApp or, you know, all these different text messages around. And so, I mean, the focus is squarely on women, but men, you know, sometimes we need protection as well.
Touching on how men can be victims of domestic violence as well, I think there are other groups that are less commonly recognized, like LGBTQ plus financially challenged communities, are the resources that we've talked about tonight and the recourse available specifically through the holistic department at the police department, are those available to those other groups?
Yes. We provide service for every group, as well as we don't discriminate, especially in this unit. And we have had cases whereas even in terms of the elderly who needed assistance as well, even persons who engage in same-sex relationships as well, we assisted them whatever case that they needed, when they needed protection order, that was done. So we do not discriminate. Once they come to us, whatever help that they need, we don't turn them away.
Thank you. We talked about the first step being going to the police. What are some of the challenges that you see in addressing that immediate concern someone's having?
Some of the concerns may be, whereas if the victim wants to leave right away and she doesn't have nowhere to go. So that basically is the main problem for most victims, and they choose to remain. But what is so excellent right now, even with this one-stop shop, we have a housing attached to this unit as well. So when victim comes in and they are running, they need to get away right away. They can't get that interim order. They can't get the protection order. They can't get into the court system, because most cases happens through the night. So the best place that they would need to come is actually to the police. And even if they need a safe space for that period of time with their children, they can receive that right then and then. Not only that, even in terms of assistance as it relates to socially, because you find a lot of victims who needs food assistance, a whole lot of them. They don't have any food. They don't have any money. They don't know how they're going to survive, because the perpetrator is the breadwinner. He is the person who's taking care of the home. And that is why a lot of women are not empowered. They are not empowered. They have given up their rights holistically to men to take care of them. So their mind is that the man is going to take care of us. So now when a situation like that happens, they don't know what to do. So and I said it earlier, it goes back to training. We have to actually stay in the school system from primary school, junior school, high school, and train our young people, because it is a learned behavior when you look at domestic violence and violence. It is a norm, because if in one side of the country or one mindset thinks that, hey, abuse is okay, violence is okay, those same children in the home is going to think that same concept, and they are going to be the ones who are committing crimes in society. So they are not going to be an asset, rather a liability.
Can you talk about when someone has come forward and they've received your services, perhaps through the night, daylight comes, and now we're facing what's happened? What are some of the protections in place for that person to remain in their report to remain confidential?
Well, that is key. That is major. That is major. Every officer attached to this unit has to sign a confidentiality form. So everything that is said to them as it relates to victims, it cannot be repeated outside of the unit. So we are major, the commissioner is actually, this is major for him. We cannot divulge that information at all. So any information that is reported to the police in this unit is kept with highest respect, with the utmost respect, because you find that it's so many persons in different part of the society who is going through this. It's not just the middle class or the lower class. You have persons in higher class. You are pastors. You hear me? You're first ladies. You have attorneys. Huh? You have teachers. So they have to know that they can report these matters and it would not be divulged, or it would not be repeated out there. and they can get that a surety that is, they can come to me. That's all.
There you go.
And Mr. Farrington, Ms. Monroe, mm-hmm. Can you speak on the confidentiality that extends through the legal process beyond the police department?
Well, I mean, for attorneys, there's always this lawyer-client privilege. And so absolutely, under no circumstances can we divulge someone's personal information. I usually crack jokes. We are the keeper of the secrets. And so we know everything about everyone. And so, we definitely can divulge people's personal, intimate information.
I second Mr. Farrington's position. The Legal Professional Act speaks to how strict we must carry confidentiality. I would say we are second to many institutions, and what springs to my mind is, if you're Catholic, confessionals. You cannot break the sanctity thereof and the seal thereof. I say so because I am Catholic. It is one of those situations where, and truly, if you're trying to assist those persons, it's counterproductive just on its face. If you're going now to deal with housing, getting them food stamps, getting them into the Women's Crisis Center as it concerns consultations and the like, it doesn't make any sense to go ahead and divulge that information. Not to mention, let's not misunderstand that these persons, quite practically and frankly, are minded to hurt the people who they quote unquote say they love. So they are minded to hurt you too, depending on how they view hurt. If they're minded to hurt their children, they're minded to hurt you too. And so to my mind, because of domestic violence is very close to my heart, it is one of those things that if you're going to do, you take seriously or you leave it alone. But these persons need help. And I think that, as was said earlier by our host, they just need to know that there's somewhere to go, there's someone who can assist. It's not going to cost you $500. There can be food, there can be shelter. Everything that Officer Wim said tonight is completely true. When you don't know how your children are going to be fed, quite frankly, that's a concern. When you don't know if there's going to be a roof over your head, that's a concern. Even beyond whether or not this person is going to, may not hit you, financially abuse you, and take all of the money out of the house for 2 weeks and see how you like it.
Yes.
I've seen people reduced to eating cat food. So I don't have to hit you. There are many ways that things happen.
So we've talked about some of the reasons that people don't come forward. What are some of the more uncommon reasons that people do come forward?
And we go into a silence because we are on radio, and so radio doesn't tolerate silence. But I think maybe that is an appropriate time for us to move into our first break. You're not going to get away from the question when we come back on the other side. So we've been discussing this issue of domestic violence. We are here at the Eugene Depute Law School. The school clinic, Legal Aid Clinic, is partnering with Organization for Responsible Governance, and we're sitting in the presence of great luminaries and great executives from Organization of Responsible Governance. We have with us our CEO, whatever he called himself these days, head cook and bottle washer, Mr. Matt Aubrey. So, but what we've tried to do up to this point is really to lay a foundation and help people to understand that there is a legal framework behind securing support. There is also, sometimes in stealth because of the nature of what is happening, a organizational or group of organizational network which is there for support, for help. Because as you rightly say, Ms. Monroe, the man who works or the woman who works, who disrupts the economics of the home by taking out all of the money, everybody going to go to bed hungry tonight. Nobody is going to get the eating out that they usually do. Nobody is going to drive in a fancy car. Nobody can buy gas. So power emanates from different places apart from physical hurt. And so we want persons to really understand and accept the fact that you may be in a circumstance that you don't readily recognize as domestic violence. But there are organizations, and it's good to hear because we've never heard this before. So it's always good when we have a forum and there's breaking news that the police force has now reorganized itself in such a way such that we have an agency which is operating at a holistic level. I did something earlier today. I ran the entire legislation through ChatGPT. Yes. And I asked it to give me a summary. And I'm going to read this for you because it aligns so much with what Ms. ASP Wim says. The Act is structured to provide a robust legal framework for addressing domestic violence, emphasizing victim protection, judicial discretion, and the importance of a swift and confidential legal process. Sound about right? It recognizes the complex dynamics of domestic violence, offering a multifaceted approach that includes immediate protection measures, long-term legal remedies, and support services for victims. We're kind of saying the same thing as a computer, aren't we? By underlining specific roles for law enforcement and social services, the Act also underscores the need for a coordinated response to domestic violence, integrating legal, social, and community resources to effectively support victims and address the root causes of abuse. There's no reason why we can't all be smart in these days. We have ChatGPT. And the point here is simple this. We want to outlay a process and a program to help persons to understand that the legal framework is in place, some other persons are in place, and we can do this. So when we come back on the other side of the break, we want to hear some war stories. We want to hear some examples without calling in because we have to be confidential as to how some persons can readily identify and associate what they're experiencing with domestic violence. You're listening to The Essential, The Reset. I'm your host, Hubert Edwards. I'm here with my co-host, Savannah Jenna Smith. Our panelists, ASP Wims, Mr. Farrington, who is a lecturer tutor here at the Eugene Deputy Law School, and Ms. Monroe, also a dynamic lecturer. If you sit through one of our advocacy class, you know, you understand what it means to love the law. This is The Essential. We want you to just go around, get yourself a little break. Don't move. Come right back.
Next Level Solutions. Next Level Solutions. Solutions. At Next Level Solutions, we assist companies and organizations to understand and strategically resolve governance, risk, compliance, regulatory, finance, and operational challenges, maximize their performance and grow. Next Level Solutions, a dynamic consultancy built on experiential knowledge. For further details on our service offerings, visit nlsolutionsbahamas.com or call 376-8951. Next Level Solutions, practical solutions delivered.
Loss of family members is very isolating, and people who have experienced loss appreciate when others have shared their grief. If you can't be there in person, go to the Nassau Guardian's website online at thenassauguardian.com and visit our obituary link. The Nassau Guardian's interactive obituary link allows you to read the funeral announcement, express condolences, or place photos on the online guestbook for one full year. Losing a loved one is painful, but that pain isn't the worst thing to happen. Friends, loved ones, colleagues, and neighbors who ignore the loss compound the pain. Should the bereaved family wish to place the obituary and photos on our obituary site, just contact the Guardian's funeral industry partners or the Nassau Guardian. Remember, there isn't one magic right thing to say to someone experiencing loss that will make the loss less painful or easier to bear. The Nassau Guardian's obituary link, available online at thenassauguardian.com.
Serious. Time for the essentials.
that we took ourselves a much needed break. We have here in the law library of the Eugene DePuge Law School, we have our illustrious lecturers, Ms. Monroe and Mr. Farrington. We also have with us ASP Wims, who is an expert in this era, supporting a lot of persons out there. She obviously is with the police force, and they play a very critical role in this. Our co-host will join us in a we having a little bit of a technical problem here. Yeah, and so we are back now. Good. So we just took ourselves a break, and on the previous side of the break, we were kind of laying the framework and getting an understanding of what the legal issues are, what the legal foundation is. We also kind of got a very good insight from ASP Wims, where she laid out exactly how the law enforcement mechanism has matured since yesterday, but really over a year or so, she indicated. And it has matured to the place where a more holistic and practical approach has been taken. Just so that we can help those persons out there who are listening to kind of understand and give themselves some sort of a benchmark or a point of reference, you know, share with us one or two unique experiences that you have come across in your sojourn dealing with domestic violence. We start with you, ASP Wims.
I have so many unique stories that I can tell. One in particular, what resonated to me so much, when a mother came into the office along with her children, and she had to leave her home because her husband, for the past 20 plus years, were emotionally and mentally abusing her. She indicated that he never physically abused her, but it was more so mental abuse. And now she is so mentally disturbed that she sees drones. And she feels as if her...
She sees what?
Drones flying in the air, following her everywhere she goes. She said she went to a number of agencies for help, but they thought that she was just crazy and they couldn't assist her. Mm-hmm. She said they thought that she needed to be enrolled in Sunderland's because she had a mental breakdown. Therefore, she left her house and she just walked with all of her bags and her children to the police station at police headquarters. Now, when she sat in the front of me, she said, "I really need help, but I think mentally I am gone. And I think it's because of the 20 plus years my husband had abused me mentally. He always accused me of cheating and never cheated on him once. He always accused me of not being good enough, even though I did my best. It was always about power and control. She left her good job because he told her that she was cheating with the boss. So she left that job. She went to another job. She left that job because he accused her again of cheating with that boss. And now she is left with nothing. He stopped taking care of her. He stopped taking care of the children. And he only gives her just enough for her to eat and the kids to eat. And she said, "What must I do?" She said, I have so much pride. I don't want to go to the church because I'm a member of a certain church. And for me to let them know this is what I've been going through all of these years, that would look very down or very bad on her and her family. Right away, I had to get her assistance in less than 5 hours. You're thinking now, what should she do? What should you do? What? You're thinking housing. You're thinking food assistance. You're thinking the need for the children as well. She only have what she is wearing on her back. That's it. Right away, we contacted Crisis Center, the Department of Social Services, and all three of us kicked in right away in assisting this woman and her six children.
Six.
Right away, they said, "Ms. Wins, we have a housing for her. 1 week." Because if you're aware, even with the housing, children and family only can get up to 1 week for the first instance, and then the second instance you can get an extension. And then you have to look at feeding these children as well as the mother. And then she doesn't want the person to know who the perpetrator is because he's well known in society. So now you're looking at the mental capacity of helping this woman. So you're looking at the psychiatrist who we had to connect with. You're looking at social services because there's a social need. You're looking at the crisis center, whereas the crisis center works holistically with the counseling as well as the social need. Then you're looking at the police force, who works in conjunction to make sure that the family and her receives all the help that she needs. And it's a follow-through process. You have to make sure that the kids, the family, everyone is well treated with respect and care. With respect and care.
That's important.
And trust. Because they have to know that they can trust you in order for them to tell you the story.
Mm-hmm. I think that's powerful.
Yes, we've got an on-topic question from our online viewers. Is emergency housing available for women with male children now? Previously, there was a challenge with this, as many shelters only do not allow males.
That has been a challenge, and it's still a challenge right now in the Bahamas. I know the Red Cross, I know they accept male children, but for most housing, they don't. The age is when a male child is 10 years old and over, they do not accept them.
I think that should be a challenge, because a 10-year-old is still a child. Our mother or father is not likely to want to leave that child behind. I think that's one of the areas. Obviously, it's an area of weakness that should be solved. As we're going to take a couple more questions, but in between hearing some of the war stories. So, Mr. Farrington, I'm sure you have had multiple lives. You were law enforcement. You're now the keeper of the secrets. So, you know, without sharing any of the secrets, your war story, one which is memorable.
Well, I actually just recently dealt with a matter where a lady, she married a foreigner. And so they've been married now for a year. Once that 1 year spousal permit expired and she renewed it for 5 years, all of a sudden he transformed. And so the video calls are incessant. She'll be at work, and he'll be video calling her. She'll be driving, he'll be video calling her. He'll be searching through her phone, searching through her bags. And so he'll be stalking her, driving past her work, sitting in the lobby, you know, while she goes to lunch, so on and so forth. He threatens her. He physically attacks her. And she is subjected to all of that. Why? Because she's embarrassed to come forward. She's embarrassed because of the prominence of her job. She's embarrassed because of her family, because according to them, they told her not to marry the guy. Obviously, they saw things that she didn't see. But love have a way of us falling fast and furious. And so for whatever reason, she's had enough, because there was a recent incident where the husband attacked her minor child with a knife. And so that was basically the last straw. But a lot of times, persons are so heavily dependent financially on the male figure, it's difficult to get out of the relationship. Because what happens now when daddy, boyfriend, husband stops paying the mortgage or the light bill or the phone bill or the rent? My little job, my minimum wage job, can't afford to take care of little Tommy, pay the rent, pay the light, pay the cable bill. And the cable bill has come out every 15th of every month, so you know. They don't hesitate to send that text message to remind you of that bill. And so a lot of time that has been the issue that we've found in the legal aid clinic. Women just don't have the financial security to leave that toxic or abusive relationship. That's the most prominent feature in most of the matters that I've dealt with.
And if that was flipped, your experience with the male, are these circumstances where you have found any male person entrenched in that type of a treatment who couldn't extricate themselves? I see you shaking your head, so maybe you have a special one.
Sorry.
Including the one with the pumps. We want to hear the one with the pumps.
I will say, while not going into too much detail, what I have had is a foreigner, ironically, came over, had his work permit, spousal permit, obtained by nature of the marriage. The wife, who was Bahamian at that moment when she figured out, well, we here now, and your reliance is on me to stay in this country. Well, it became a little crazy there for a while. it became everything from cook, clean, everything. And that's not a horrible thing because that's just marriage. Then it started to go to, I'm just going to have extramarital affairs and you just come home and meet me in flagrante delicto. you're not in a position to say anything. Then it was every single dollar that you make on whatever job you're having under the table, I take it from you. It was going out, never coming home. It got crazy there for a moment. It was actually in a matrimonial situation, so we had to do the domestic violence beforehand because you can do it at Supreme Court as well. We had to do the domestic violence application beforehand and then the divorce second, simultaneous. But it got really bad there to the point where she started to beat him. It doesn't always have to be that kind of abuse, but belittling him and undermining him to the point where one day she kind of just put him out the house in basically his underwear. It was inappropriate in anyone's stance. And she left him out there in the rain.
Wow. And so I think that story, and I kind of nudge you to the male side of it. I think it's important that we talk about these things because we live in a society which oftentimes really stereotype issues based on gender. So this is a woman issue or this is a man issue. Man don't cry, woman seek help. Man don't go to a doctor, woman always healthy. That type of a dynamic operates very, very steeply in our society. And so we have to, in this process, I think if we are going to help persons, we have to help them to debunk that type of a thinking. We want to say to individuals out there, one of the bases of this conversation is that we want you to understand that there is help for human beings, everybody. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what your religious background is, what your sexual orientation is. As long as you're a human being, because I don't think the laws operate for aliens at this point in time. But as long as you're a human being, the law and the framework is in place. The law enforcement is in place. And the other social organizations are there ready and willing and waiting to help to the extent. A large part of the reason many individuals do not actually get the help, apart from getting over the fear and maybe finally deciding, yes, this is going to be the last straw, is because they believe that they cannot by themselves navigate the process. And so we are here to say, certainly on behalf of Mr. Farrington, who will see you when you come to the Legal Aid Clinic, that you won't be by yourself. The reason the Legal Aid Clinic exists is to help to afford access to justice. We know that there are persons out there who cannot afford Ms. Monroe on a working day. But on her pro bono day, she is very much, very much available. And she does that. She says that continuously, and that's the reason why she's on this panel. So we want persons to remember that because you cannot afford a certain type of legal facilitation, there are other means by which, and the Legal Aid Clinic is one of the great places to start. So we're going to leave that there, and we're going to see if we can take some questions. We have persons also in the audience. We're going to get a couple of questions and comment from. But Savannah, do you have another question?
If I may, before you move on, separate and apart from ASP WIMS and the Legal Aid Clinic, the Office of the Judiciary website, they have an excellent supply of forms, court forms. So you could actually go onto that website and you could download the fillable forms and you could fill out the documents yourself. You don't even need an attorney for that. So let's say, for example, something happens now, the court is closed, you already made your complaint to the police, you could go right on the Office of the Judiciary website, download the relevant forms, fill them out, and first light, you can go straight to the magistrate's court and file the documents yourself. Yeah.
Yes.
So they've made access to justice even more readily available.
And I think that's an important piece of information to have. And one of the output from this session is going to be, we are going to create a pamphlet, which will highlight a number of frequently asked questions. Certainly that's one of the questions that we want to put on there to say to persons, do the thing in the stealth of night, get down there first thing in the morning and secure the help you need. But just in case you are a little bit timid, find Mr. Farrington, find Ms. Wims, and on a good day, you may be able to find Ms. Monroe. Next question.
Are applications for domestic violence protection orders held in camera, in private, or are they held in open court?
They're held in private.
For obvious reasons. Yeah. Other than the court staff who will receive the document for filing, the magistrate will see you, and the clerk who will be inside the court will hear you. And the bailiff, sorry, because you will need to be sworn. But outside of that, that is what would happen. Before you even leave the court that day, you can leave with your interim protection order. They will ask you to sit down for a moment. And in fact, they normally happen before actual court hearings are heard, much like bound overs, because you want to kind of get in and get out because, as was previously stated, it may well be that I need this in this moment. To the extent that your interim order can truly reflect what a final order is. And even in that moment, if you need what we call an occupation order, which is not just simply serve him or her, it may well be change the locks. It may well be you get to move somewhere. Certain those things may well be needed. So when I give my consult to my clients, I say to them, you need to think about it holistically and practically. Does this man know of, or woman, know about the one window in the back that does not work? And how can you protect or safeguard yourself? Is this a situation where if you have the finances, tonight is the night you book a hotel room somewhere because it doesn't make any sense to stay here? Or do you need to avail yourself of some resources that you won't be around him or her because their abusers are not happy when they are served with these types of documents?
I do know that where the current family courts are now on Nassau Street, the criminal courts are there, the civil courts are there, traffic court is there. There was a recent interview with the current Chief Justice, Justice Winder, and he said that the entire family division in the magistrate's court as well as the Supreme Court will be relocated on Bernard Road, you know, where the old Success Complex is. And so that particular environment would be sensitive and conducive for these kind of matters. So rather than having to share space or a parking lot or a seat with someone who has a criminal matter or a civil matter, that space will have a nursery, it'll be non-adversarial. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be private, it'll be sensitive to, you know, the victim's needs. Right. And it's an environment that will create that kind of level of comfort where someone can say to the court, this is what I've experienced in this relationship.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, I think, is so important. We have some questions from the audience. Do we have questions from the audience? As they put their questions together, we know we have Matt Aubrey here with us. He is from Organization of Responsible Governance. And so, you know, we have gotten into a lot of the law and understanding the process, not in its minutia, but we certainly would have laid a broad foundation for that. So I think it's important at this point in time to at least get some comment from you, Matt. You represent the civil society for the time being. And of course, Organization for Responsible Governance plays a significant role in what is happening. I don't know if they can hear you. You may have to pop up and just grab the mic. Yes. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for this impromptu invitation. I think the Organization for Responsible Governance, our mission is really about how we not only promote the principles of good governance, but engage citizens, engage the private sector, engage all of our sectors, our churches, our schools, our media, our academia, our youth, all the marginalized communities that we have out there. And I, you know, whether it be youth or women or LGBTQ plus or folks with disabilities, or in our context, those folks in our family islands, because they are that much further removed from having access. So when we talk about these issues and we talk about them at high levels as you have, it's really crucial, and Hubert, I think you're fantastic at this, bringing it down to what are basic things. So you've brought forms that people can access online, you've brought resources. I know the Domestic Violence Unit is doing a whole host of activities over the next number of months that are going to be bringing it into the community. That's so crucial because thinking about the person that's going to be affected by it, they have so many social obstacles, they have so many challenges. They might be very nervous to bring it to a formal space, to bring it to a place, to try pursue legals. So what we see as really viable spaces in our community are those not-for-profit organizations that are out in the community offering these services, whether they be the Crisis Center, which is an incredibly dedicated team of volunteers that you can call at any given time, whether it be folks like Equality Bahamas or the DeMarco Foundation or FOAM, which is looking for and helping folks on a daily basis. Those are places where folks can start to at least find an entry point that might be more comfortable, it might be accessible in their community, and that will then hopefully lead them into some of the more formal channels. So as we gather here today, I think it's really important to give that shout out to, and maybe again, ask the panel, talk a little about some of those community groups that are there, some, you know, churches and youth groups and those types of spaces. Can be very powerful. We've even heard in some of the work we've done that places in schools, the student governments, the school counselors, these are some safe spaces that I think we want to make sure people get, because sometimes in the midst of a crisis, you may not be thinking about that.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Matt. And again, we thank you for your cooperation in doing this with us. And we are doing this very strategically because we understand that once we finish here tonight, we expect that the discussion, the things that we have said, the foundations that we have laid, the information we laid out will be consumed on an ongoing basis. And so that there are persons out there who may not be tuning in at this very minute, they will be able to access that information. It's going to be on a multiplicity of social media sites, and therefore individuals will be able to garner that. So if you're out there and you're listening, what your job is when you know of an individual who is in a particular circumstance, or if you don't, when you happen to come across an individual in a particular circumstance, direct them to where the information is. We are not trying to give you every single aspect that could have been given from a legal perspective. But what we want you to understand is that, you know, we're not just having a talk about, you know, if somebody pinch you, you can come over here and tell me and I'll help you be unpinched. No, the Bahamas as a country have a firm legal framework in place, and individuals which include, well, organizations which include the police force and other social organization that it works with. And for all of us, me and my colleagues, my fellow students in Group F, we are all proud to be a part of Eugene DePuig Law School and be associated with the Legal Aid Clinic, as Mr. Farrington, our lecturer, will readily tell you. It's a place where persons who can't go anywhere else can come. And they're going to find help. And so, Matt, you know, this, I think, is very important that we are partnering with a social organization like Organization for Responsible Governance. And so, you know, we will continue the conversation. So we want to thank you very much and salute your work in the community.
Thank you. I will say one of the other, and we're joined here by our assistant director, Stefan Evans, and our engagement manager, Ariane Wells, and our incredible utility player, Vanessa Bethel, who are out in the community and have gone to most of the islands and continue to do so. And we can't take the point enough that people need to hear this a lot in different spaces and in different ways. They need to take information that is complex and make it very accessible. When we go out, our whole goal is to listen, hear what challenges are, help people figure out how they can regain their voice and what they call their agency. Mm-hmm. And you can't be in having less agency when you're in a circumstance where you're victimized. So we really need to make sure that it's a whole of community approach and that resources get where they need to. So
definitely.
So our tagline is always get informed and get involved. And I think we have to think about that on every level, not just if you see yourself directly affected, because you might be at risk sometime for future in your life, or someone you love might be.
So, you just never know.
Let's open that up.
Thank you so much, very much, Matt. And I think, in the legal profession, they always say, let the record show that the Eugene DePuig Law School through the Legal Aid Clinic is playing its part in making sure that works. We want to, if we have additional questions, we will take those. You have a question here? Let's get that question and pass the mic around quickly. Go ahead.
Good night.
Night.
Tonight. I would like to know, how would someone go about getting a restraining order without their abuser knowing?
How you get a restraining order without your abuser knowing?
or protection order.
When you say restraining order, are you talking about
the protection order?
Okay. So again, you can either go online, Office of the Judiciary website, and you could download the form yourself, and you could complete the form, go to the magistrate court complex on Nassau Street, and I think Ms. Monroe said earlier, the cost is maybe $3 to file a document. Once you file a document, you go before a magistrate, you swear under oath as to whatever the allegations are, and then you would obtain maybe like a police officer who would serve the document on him. So up until that point, he's unaware of whatever, you know, what your plans are. But once he's served with the document, then the document on the face of it tells him that you are hereby stopped from threatening me, assaulting me, stalking, harassing, so on and so forth. And like ASP Wim said earlier, the turnaround window before you have an opportunity to give that evidence before a magistrate is usually maybe 2 weeks, sometimes even less. And so, unbeknown to him, you file the application. He's made aware once he's served with the document, but then again, the document tells him on the face of it what he can and cannot do. And once you appear before the magistrate, then the magistrate can fully ventilate the matter, and hopefully you can obtain the domestic violence protection order.
Thank you so much, Ms. Martin. Another question? No other questions? Yeah. So we have a couple of Zoom chat. Go ahead.
Are there any male officers attached to the Domestic Violence Protection Unit? And can a male officer interview a person seeking help that at the unit if they prefer not to speak with a female officer?
I am proud to say, very proud to say, that we have two males, very competent males attached to the unit, very professional. So they are willing and able to assist in any which form or fashion. They also assist victims as well as females as well. And some of our female victims even prefer that a male assist them, you know, when they come there. So we both males that we have attached there are trained. They are trained males. They know what to say. They know how to deal with our victims or our complainants. So, yes, we do have males attached to the unit.
There's a large non-English-speaking population in our country. Are all of the resources that we've discussed, the police department and at the legal aid clinic, available to them? And then can you also touch on the immigration impacts that may be
one of the drivers
of
some of the domestic violence issues?
Well, we have access to local interpreters. We have a matter now, it's not a domestic violence matter, but we have a matter now that involves guardianship of minor children, and we would occasionally bring in local interpreters that are certified by the government, by the courts, who would translate for us, either the oral translation or the written translation, and that's in any language. Once you go to one of the local embassies, they'll be able to direct you to persons who, you know, they have a list of persons who they usually recommend. Yeah.
We also have access to interpreters. We also have even police officers who we have access to, who also assist us with cases as well, just to expedite the cases, especially if you can't access one immediately. So that hasn't been a challenge thus far, especially in dealing with our investigations.
And someone who's fearing coming forward and reporting domestic violence for possibly being deported or someone in their family reported as being here undocumented, is that something that's taken into consideration during the intake process when they're reporting?
I've seen cases with persons who were undocumented and they needed housing especially, as well as food assistance, a lot of social needs. So we have assisted them as well. Social services always on board to assist those cases, you know, holistically. So they don't need to fail, or they don't need to be afraid that they're going to be arrested, you know, or anything of that nature. So once they come to us, they don't have no fear at all. We still will be able to assist them.
If I could add to that as well, the law, the Domestic Violence Protection Order Act, makes provision for persons other than the victim to approach the court. So
anyone
the Commissioner
also,
of Police through ASP Williams, the Department of Social Services, another member in the household mm-hmm. can make an application. And in some circumstances, the person could even ask leave of the court. You may have a neighbor who, you know, witnessed some domestic violence. And because the victim is afraid to come forward, the neighbor can approach the court and ask the court for leave to make an application on that person's behalf. And once the summons or the document is served on both parties, they're compelled to appear before the court. And so that takes away the fair element from the victim. The neighbor made the complaint, not me.
Yeah. So the message from that, Mr. Farrington, to all persons out there listening, is that the avenues for securing help is good. Is great, right?
There's help.
Because
there's
if
help.
My neighbor just don't want to be nosy, I can tell them, you know, tell him, I need you to stand in this particular place and be nosy on this particular day because I am unable to do the reporting. And I need you to do that. The message we need to send to everyone, and usually we find it's individuals who are in vulnerable circumstances, who do not have sufficient finances and stuff, is that do not allow what you perceive as a difficulty to not go and find help. Our job here tonight is to bring awareness to you of the fact that legislation exists within the Bahamas, which facilitates you being helped, which allows you to be protected, which allows a process to take care of you and your family. We have organizations through the police and working with other agencies that does that. We have organizations who will help you from a representation, from a legal representational point of view, at a very minimal cost or near no cost. And so you have to, at the end of the day, make sure you do that. And then we also have illustrious lawyers who are in the private sector, like our great teacher here, Ms. Monroe, who gives up her time and effort as a means of giving back to society in this way. And so, you know, I think it's important that persons understand that there is help and it is for them to step forward, be bold, be brave, and try to find a way of solving that. As these things always go, Savannah, we always have great conversations. We always talk about good things, but we are always bounded by time. We have about 9 minutes to go. And as a result of that, we'll have just really wind this conversation down. But we want to look at it not as a conversation in and of itself, but the start of something important, the start of maybe a series of legal awareness sessions that the Legal Aid Clinic partnering with other social entities within the country will do from time to time. And it will be said that Group F started this, and that will go down in history, let the record so reflect. But as we come to the end of this discussion for tonight, we just want to have your closing views. What are your thoughts? What are some of the things that you would want to leave with an individual who is out there listening and who feels that, hey, the world is closing in on me, but these people are saying that there's help. Convince them that this is true. It's not just talk. Help is there. Help is on the way.
What I would say just briefly is you're not alone. There are persons out here who are willing to help you. There is an infrastructure. There is a community. There are places you can go. There are places I have run full tilt through, as we have mentioned, and lost a whole shoe, trying to get persons to safety in times when, you know, the funds may not always be there, but, you know, you want to take care of yourself. You want to take care of your children. You want to take care of your household. And you have to ask yourself, if you've never asked it before, is this the life I want to live for forever? And if the answer is no, please find help. And help is available. It really is.
Yes. Thank you so much, Ms. Monroe. Mr. Farrington?
I think that a lot of times we don't appreciate things that happen now has a generational repercussion. And so you may have a child who witnessed his mother or his father as a victim of domestic violence. And to him, that's normal. And so if you are involved in a situation and you're a victim, then we would encourage you to seek help. You don't even have to go to the police. You don't have to come to the Legal Aid Clinic. You don't have to go to another lawyer. You can, again, download the forms and you can file the documents yourself. Even though the circumstances now at Nassau Street, you may find yourself, again, sitting next to someone who may have a criminal matter or civil matter, within the next few weeks or few months, and relocating on Bernard Road, where that particular space will be sensitive and conducive to domestic violence. And so if you're not compelled to do it now, then just tarry a while. Help is coming.
Yes.
Otherwise, if it's that urgent, I would advise you to approach the police. Make sure everything is documented. Whatever happens, make a complaint to the police. ASP Williams, those are doing a wonderful job in their public relations, not only to the public, but in educating police officers. So chances of you being turned away and directed to the court, I think, has minimized over the past year or so. And so make your complaint to the police. Visit ASP Williams at headquarters. And then
take it from there.
You could come to the Legal Aid Clinic.
Okay. ASP Williams?
If I could just sum it up, I would say, do not suffer in silence. Do not suffer in silence. You owe it to your children. You owe it to your family. You owe it to your future generation to come. Do not suffer in silence. And there is help. If you just reach out, if you need to find me, my contact is 302-8485. My cell is 477-4579.
Wow. 477.
45.
45.
79.
79.
You can reach me anytime.
I can't be that transparent.
Okay, put up.
Yeah, go ahead. That's it? That's all you want to say. So, Savannah, it was certainly a pleasure sitting here as your co-host. You took over tonight, and I was playing wingman. But, it was certainly a pleasure to be with you. Your thoughts?
I think I certainly learned a lot this evening, and I hope that we provided the public with some information and some resources and on a practical level of how they can receive some help.
Yeah. And as we kind of do a little bit of a debrief, as we see our illustrious director sitting in the wings and trying to understand, did we cover everything? We touched tonight on the legal framework. I kind of identified and highlighted aspects of the legislation. We delve into, through Ms. Monroe, the definition, Section 3, and broaden our understanding of what domestic violence is. It's not just physical beating, it's emotional, it's financial. We did also get into some of the aspects, how do you go about getting a protective order? We also look at the fact that it's not limited to the individual who is being abused, so to speak, but any member of the household, the commissioner of police can do it. Obviously, he won't do it, he'll just send it to ASP Williams. And so it's a broad swath of individuals who are out there. And of course, we underline the fact that the Eugene Depuch Law School Legal Aid Clinic is willing and able, once the circumstances check out, to support individuals. And many times, I would think that support is going to be, let us help point you in the right direction. And just in case your circumstance is so complex, we're going to stand with you from a legal perspective. Anything else we have missed in that summarization?
I think you did a great job, as usual.
You think I do a great job in covering that. And so it is for us right now to start to understand that the conversation that we have started here this evening is a conversation which must continue. It's a conversation which must take place on a continuous basis, because not just because of the individuals who are impacted, but because as a collective, when we weaken our women, when we weaken our children, when we ASP whims, create circumstance which degenerates generation yet to come, we are weakening a country. And if we weaken a country, then everyone is going to suffer in the long run. And so we are at a place now where we understand that there's a legal framework in place. We understand that we can, find access to support. And so we are encouraging persons out there, regardless of who you are, find the help you need. Understand the legislation is there to protect you. And as someone rightly said, this cuts right across all demographic. It's not just poor people who is in this. Persons are out there and are unwilling to come forward simply because they don't want to be known, simply because they are Mr. Him or Mr. He in society. But understand that the legislation itself is grounded significantly in confidentiality. And your information can be shared. No person can go out and talk about your business. So you should step forward. And so it was certainly a pleasure for us to bring this to you tonight. We partnered with Organization for Responsible Governance, and we have to give a big shout out to the Guardian Reader organization, which allowed us to broadcast this. We are on a number of social media. It will be available. It's going to be on YouTube, the school YouTube channel. So you want to go out there and you want to find it and you want to send it to somebody. And certainly you liked a lot of things which you heard here tonight. So I want you to give it a click, give it a like, give it a share, because that is important. That is how we spread the word. So all that is left to say tonight is to thank all of the persons who participated. Thank you, panelists. Thank you, co-hosts. Thank you, persons who are working in the background. We always end our show by saying, do not allow your greatness to become a victim of your unwillingness to change. And after saying that, the only thing which is left to say is, what good be good, one love, and Ubuntu. Good night.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.